Good afternoon. So I'm Daniel Bellin from the School of Public Policy, and I'm here to introduce our speaker, a speaker many of you already know, Keith Walker, who is professor at the Johnson Shoyama School and in the Department of Educational Administration in the College of Education, actually just next door. And so Keith Walker is a very prolific scholar. He has published many, many articles and a number of books on issues related to educational administration, leadership development, and applied ethics and governance, among other things. And we are really glad to have him here to talk about ethical leadership for sustainable development in Africa. So thank you very much, Keith. Regina, you can hear me?
Yes, no? Okay, well, can hear loud and clear.
Very good. So, Keith, it's all yours, and after that, we'll entertain questions from the crowd here in Saskatoon, as well as people in Regina. Thank you, Keith.
Thanks very much, Daniel, and thanks to those of you in Regina here in Saskatoon that have joined us today. I, myself, enjoy these talks and the various activities of the School of Public Policy. And it's such a delight to have a school that is a two-university school on two campuses, one school, and so pleased to be a part of that. And thank you for your attendance here. The topic has been advertised as ethical leadership for sustainable development in Africa, and we'll stay with the advertised topic for the day. The in Africa part will contextualize the talk today, but my hope is that all of you that are here will be able to resonate whether you come from Africa, whether that you an observer, a student of the African context, or whether you're an observer or like me, a leader watcher here in and from North America. There's certainly lots on the go there, so certainly we'd be pleased to have you consider the topic of leadership generally, leadership with a, we'll say, an ethical lean, and in the context of this dream, if you like, this aspiration to see sustainable development flourish, particularly where it's most needed, and as we'll demonstrate, well, certainly much of Canada has need of sustainable development. Sometimes forget that when we look at what is often referred to as the two-thirds world, not the third world, but the two-thirds world, where we see so much in the way of need, and with that need is certainly a need for hope. Well, the African context is definitely an interesting one and a complex one for us to look at. And what I want to do today is just use that context and a little bit of, I'll say, my own juxtaposition, my own occasioning into the African context to just bring a few things forward to you. I'll just give you a bit of an outline of the things that I'd like to review for you, and you'll see one of these topics is particularly highlighted, and that's where I'll spend most of my time. I will do some delimitations. I want to put this talk in the context just as a sort of almost a backstage, the notion of the millennial goals, and paint a little bit of the African context and the complexity. I want to, in a light way, argue for the leadership difference, that leadership can and does make a difference. I'll put the conversation in the context of a particular event, a forum that was held in Namibia, and we'll look at the notion of an emerging vision for ethical leadership for sustainability in Africa as we move through. It can't help but be a skimming over the surface kind of lecture today, just simply because of the complexity of the context, of the topic, the idiosyncratic aspects of the public service across different countries. And I would just say that there are people in this room that are experts, certainly in sustainable development. I'm not. There are certainly people that are experts in Africa in this room. I am not. That caveat and those delimitations set out, let me provide a few observations for you. I think we're all familiar with the eight goals, the millennial goals. If any of you have been since early 2000s in the United Nations building, they have this great display at the center of that universe, if you like, to show this great and desperate need that we have, this great hunger that we have worldwide, to give particular attention to particular aspects of what it is that we need to do to make this a better world for everyone. We have one planet, and we're using up a way more resources than that planet can afford. We have billions of people, and too many of them are going hungry at night. These are things that have been faced and are expressed in a rather succinct set of goals, and with those goals, targets, with those goals and targets, national, countrywide, and sector-wide monitoring just to see how well we're doing. In some cases, the expression of results for this big task, and I say big task, is not being met by the capacity of sectors and countries to take care of, to absorb the needs. These are prescriptions in a sense. They're generalized prescriptions with more specific targets that ask us to digest remedies, usually contextually applied into particular situations. Situations that have histories that make it very complicated, and structures, systems that make it very difficult to incorporate these aspirations, these dreams that are reflected in the millennial goals, which in some ways are quite minimalistic in terms of human rights and human flourishing. Just was working with some of my students last term using Martha Nussbaum's book on capabilities, another turn and an approach to looking at the millennial goals and what it is that human flourishing really does call out for us to work with and do. And yet the capacity is somewhat limited to do that. While there is hope, unquestionably hope, and as Michael Atkinson and I have written in a chapter entitled Warranted Hope, we need to really also define reality at the same time, as opposed to being just superficially optimistic about the direction of things. And there's a more recent report that you could look at from 2011, but just at a glance, if you can see the slide, if you look at the goals for just using the sub-Saharan Africa settings, so many of those goals, there is deterioration marked as opposed to on track or accomplishing those goals. So, and this isn't done usually in lectures, but I'll do it anyhow. Whether you're in Regina or Saskatoon, could you just put your hands up in the air like this? This is just unusual, isn't it? But we'll do it anyhow. Imagine an elastic band tied around your hands, the top hand and the bottom hand. The hope that I talked about is the top hand. It pulls things up. It's the ideals. And the bottom hand are the realities. And we face those all the time. That's good. I just want you to have that physical sense of what we're dealing with here. It's a huge tension. It's a big gap. And the tensions are experienced differently in different places. And the first and the last job of a leader, of any leader, whether they're positional leader or just simply living in a way that desires to make a difference and is one by one, day by day, even leader moment by leader moment, making a difference, the number one job is to foster hope. Unquestionably, we need to have leaders who foster hope and, in fact, develop cultures of hope despite numbers and signals, as we have on the slide in front of us now, where in most of the target areas, it's off track in terms of the goals, or there's even a deteriorating situation. But it's also very important for leaders to actually define reality and help people to face reality. That's the bottom hand. And it's those two pieces held in tension that in some ways illustrate the importance of developing leadership cultures. Certainly, in the area of sustainable development and any leader action, any system action, there are lots of offered possibilities. Often by armchair quarterbacks that live thousands of miles away and live in buildings where the air is a little bit thin, making all sorts of academic suggestions in terms of what would work good on the ground in a long way away. And I'm not saying that we don't have the technology to take a missile that is an idea or an initiative missile from one place and make it work extremely well in another place, but we've tended not to be all that good at it, and very often we find solutions that really aren't solving the problem. They are sort of like candy floss. You know, looks big, looks attractive, spend whatever they cost now at the exhibition in terms of buying it because it does look attractive, but all it really ultimately leaves you with is pink stain on your hand. You really don't get much for it. And there are lots of things that we have been doing that aren't giving us the traction, that aren't making a difference. Or there are other explanations why the money hasn't gone to the right place, why the intention was good, but it wasn't suitable or appropriate for that particular place. The attention of the Commonwealth, 50-plus countries, but 19 of those countries in Africa, is with so many other agents, and this is just one agency of coordination that gives attention to bringing these countries together to see what they can learn from one another and to be encouraging to one another at lots of different levels and with some very targeted kind of programs. The Commonwealth Secretariat website, for those of you in public policy, is a fascinating one to travel through just to see all that is going on with that organization and all of its attendant agencies. But these are the countries that I had in mind and as I'll say, sat with as we were talking about some of these issues. One of the reasons that things aren't getting traction, and it's often given as a major reason, is this notion of corruption. And if you're looking at the slide that's up before you, red is not good in this instance, or the shades of it. In the case of Africa, there is only one that I believe makes the top 35 in terms of what could be called clean or very clean kinds of countries. And so Africa, while obviously there are countries around the world that have these high corruption perception numbers, it's certainly one that has this as a concern. You can see this by the red. There are definitely hopes, and interestingly enough, a lot of those hopes and the progress that's being made in this area has been made consciously and intentionally by particular efforts that are being made by countries, and particularly, I would say, in the last 20 years, but particularly in the last 10 years. The notion of ethical leadership is not at all new to the African concept. In fact, they probably give us a lot of the ethics that we have if we were actually to track things back in the big royal they. They are many, and with 50-plus countries, there's just such a diversity there. We are starting to actually see some very interesting concepts from African culture coming into the Western culture that I think we need to be paying attention to. But this is a a slide that's not a happy slide. There's always two ways of going about things. One is to blame. It's because of corruption. Or the other way of going might be saying, well, perhaps we need to just up the leadership game. And maybe there's other aspects as well. One of the most intriguing writers from the African context has just written a marvelous book on this topic, but in a deep, deep fashion, just using Nigeria as his case, explaining the great complexity of that place, but also suggesting there are two basic ways that failed states and inability of the public service and other civil society agencies to get sustainability going with traction. One is the culprit of bad or corrupt leadership. Now, it could be the absence of it or the lack of presence of it. You can swing that in a couple of different kinds of ways. But he goes on in this slide, which you can download from the school website should you want to do that sometime, into the great complex of all that's entailed by this proxy of leadership, failed or otherwise. But there's also an explanation. While it may be a minority explanation, it's nonetheless has some truth in it, I think, and that is that, well, just keep in mind that in 1945, I believe, and someone will correct me on this for sure, but there were about 60 independent states in the world. 60, 1945. For some of us, that wasn't so long ago. For others, it was in several other people's lifetimes ago, but nonetheless, 1945, 60 independent states, and today we have about 190 independent states. So what we have here is a relatively immature statehood in terms of independent statehoods. And it takes time to mature. The world has not become less complicated in the meantime. And all you need is a failed marketplace, for example, that just becomes a hiccup and an issue. You only need to add the tragedy of war and famine and so forth for these continent countries, but other countries around the world, to really feel the pinch of what it is to be maybe not even adolescent in terms of growth in independence. You don't go from being under a colonial power, whatever form it came, and immediately translate into maturity as a state. And it may very well be, he says subtly, that there continues to be apron strings or leashes or factors that continue to press and perpetuate the colonialism. Not to say anything about corporate imperialism and so forth. There are lots of other explanations. Those just suffice for now. But here we go into the notion of this vision, this idea, this dream of sustainable development and people flourishing. And how does this idea take hold? Well, you say, well, it's a good idea. Of course, we'll just go with it. Well, if you've not experienced it in some cultures, your ceiling, your level of experience of what it is to be flourishing might have you with lower expectations that you might otherwise have. And it is an interesting question about how ideas shape culture. And I'm just going to put out to you now, without wanting to argue it too robustly, that ideas, dreams, goals, ambitions, what it is to be a flourishing place with sustainable development, come to us through leaders, through the elite or dominant culture, and through networks and plural influencers. Now, there are obviously other factors. If you can have a cell phone in the middle of nowhere, and be able to pick up the media of a place that's doing better than you, then you see the gap quite quickly. But in terms of actually shaping the ambition from a nation-building perspective, leaders, elites, networks, and plural influences are really what it's about. And let me just say that we need to probably just look at our vocabulary a little bit. The word leadership is the one that I would use most often. And you don't usually say, there goes a leadership. You might say, there goes a leader. Leadership isn't an individual attribute. I'll just stipulate that. We could argue it, but I'll just put that forward. But rather, it's a collective process. It's a shared property. It's a condition. It's an effect. Like a relationship. It doesn't reside in a person. It resides between and amongst people. So one of our great important notions that we have is that the person on the white horse that is going to come and bring ethical leadership or sustainable development or cause all the people within the scope of their domain to become flourishing all at once is likely not going to work, not at least in a sustained kind of fashion. But what about the idea of leadership and culture and making a difference, for example, in the public service? A public service isn't the exclusive place where sustainable development takes place, but it's certainly a major one for any country, including our own here in Canada. When there is an ethical culture of management and leadership, we know that there's a high correlation between that and engagement of the people who are delivering the service down the entire chain. You can, and I'd invite you to look at the Ethics Resource Center, the Hay reports that have been done in the last few years in this. I'll just skip through these quite quickly. When there is high observed misconduct that's taking place, you have a shrinkage of engagement. Where there is a strong ethical culture, the pressure to do untoward behavior that's either selfish, greedy, malicious, or otherwise toxic, the likelihood of observing misconduct, the failure to report, is much reduced, including retaliation. So if you can get your ethical culture strong, it has the effect of reducing what in some is aggregated in people's mind as corruption, or the barriers that are keeping us from moving ahead or being the best we possibly can. This is true of the organization you're working in today, the school you're going to, or the country that you're from. I think it applies generally, at least I'm going to suggest it does. And with that hypothesis, feel free to test that out. I'll just skip through some of these and get to an event from last July, so a half a year ago now. An eighth assembly of a group of people who, and the titles change, of course, from country to country, and some are foreign sounding to us in a way. Permanent secretaries, secretaries to cabinet, some of these positions we have here, we would think of deputy ministers, for example. But the public service, not the elected group, but the bureaucratic group, the heads of the public service for the 19 African countries, the names of those countries displayed earlier, gathered together for the purpose of talking about the things that I'm just wanting to share with you here today. Prior to that meeting, they had said this: public servants are trustees of the public resources and have an obligation to satisfy collective needs as demanded by citizens, and that citizens need to be informed about how resources are used, by whom, and for what results. So there's a standard bearing that's taking place there. Here's what integrity or wholeness is of the public service: is closely connected to a country's competitiveness, and that a country that is perceived as being high in integrity will be more attractive to investors. Certainly, there's a great, great need today in this economy today. And I'll just pause there. Some of you will have seen Jeffrey Sachs' newer book, and seen there that, interestingly, he suggests, what is the number one thing that's keeping us back? And my read of the book is his answer to that is cynicism, a pervasive cynicism. But where does that come from? It comes from a frustration with the system. And I'm not saying that that is continent specific. It can happen here and otherwise as well. And that deep, and he calls it pervasive cynicism, is a huge issue, and it's quite unattractive. Ethics and values have meaning only if they go beyond legal instruments to be anchored in culture. This is the words of the heads of the public service in Africa, the Commonwealth ones. Anchored in culture to mold personality and character of the public servants as they are engaged in the work of serving the public. Group of appointed, that is self-appointed people were brought together before this meeting and began to scope out what it was that they felt they needed to help mutually come together and get some traction on some of these things. It's about traction. And here's what they said. Generally accepted that leadership is at the core of sustainable development because visionary leaders are necessary to articulate and communicate a bigger picture to inspire everyone towards attaining national objectives and goals. Millennial goals, for example. Mobilizing everyone to be a part of the national development agenda is also an attribute of good leadership that should facilitate sustainable development. So they're making the connection. It's not my connection, it's their connection, seeing that leadership, a leadership culture, and sustainability are inextricably linked. And that the public service, while not having an exclusive role, has a pivotal role, and that the quality of leadership in the public service will, to a large extent, be the keeper of the capacity, the larger or deteriorating capacity of a country. And it was their view, the smaller group, that getting right leadership at all levels, not just singular leadership, but plural leadership, networks of leadership, elites in leadership, different civil society leadership going. The King's Report that some of you would know from South Africa, talking about corporate leadership, board leadership, all sector leadership happening and moving in, we'll just say, a good positive direction towards sustainable development are prerequisites. According to those leaders. On the school website, you'll if you're interested, you'll see a large background paper on there. I say large because I think the text beyond references is about 90 pages. But you'll see a background paper that would sort of elaborate on some of the points that I'll just make and make fairly briefly here. So, if you see that slide, it may not be all that accessible to you, depending on where you're seated. But there are two bookends. One is about the desires for a transformation to take place in terms of sustainable development. And on the other side, the achievement of that sustainable development and those marker goals, let's just say the millennial goals. And what's in between? What are the gap fillers? I've got, five gap fillers in there in terms of categories. I'd suggest you could easily come up with 10 good categories, perhaps some of them better than these. But these are the ones that I would offer with particular attention to the first two. And the way this seemingly complex chart works is really quite simple. I'm saying that vision for ethical leadership, beginning with just a vision of what leadership would look like, that good leadership that was described, is a good starting place. Because if, in fact, you don't have it, here's how you interpret the chart. There will be confusion and there will be purpose drift, amongst other things. So you need to at least have people with the ideations, the aspirations to see not just single leaders, but leadership and ethical leadership permeate the cultures of the public service. You can have commitments, you can have incentives, the resources can be there, you can even have an action plan, but if you don't have that vision to begin with, you'll have some slowdown. And so you can use this little chart as a bit of an indicator. I'd suggest if you're serious about it, you might make it more complex, because it is. And it's not rational And it's not technical sometimes, these things. It's, I'm not suggesting any linearity or order of these, but just simply to say, if there isn't, if you go to the second piece, commitments to translate values and ethics into the culture itself, then you're going to end up with anxiety and just superficial activity. It's unsustainable. You actually need to embed and act and begin to actually see ethical behavior and ideas embodied by the entire public service. And it may just simply be one unit at a time, but that needs to be part of that vision. So, how do the heads of these public service see ethical leadership for sustainable development for their countries? One way of expressing it would be through this model that we together spent several days working with through modifying and so forth. If at the very center of the attention is this dream for a flourishing country, a flourishing continent, where at the very least millennial goals are on track, tracking, and being dealt with in a way that are altogether sustainable. There's a requirement that there be some commitments, some enduring commitments. One of the things we often find in leadership literature is that leadership is defined as creating and maintaining change. But what happens with that, constancy, change, you get this oscillation effect. Add to that multiple regimes taking place. Elections every couple of years, tribal factions, on and on and on. You get an oscillatory kind of an effect, and you don't have a stabilizing effect. Rather, if you take that hand action again, it was for this purpose, you can reduce the oscillation by vision, by commitment, by actually pulling together the chaotic, the constant chaos, the attempts to bring order. You can bring sensibility to it through core commitments, and if those can be permeate throughout the public service, and with ideals and with good intentions, with people of character and competence. Typically, we say in leadership that a person fails if they're missing one or both of those, character or competence. It's very difficult to imagine it. I'm talking now about a single leader, a positional leader. If they don't have competence, good luck. If they don't have character, they'll last a little longer, it seems, in this day and age, but they'll nonetheless eventually fail on themselves. The other way of looking at it, too, just to spin off, another way of looking at it is leaders fail if they don't have vision, and if they don't have virtue. Both are requirements. You can't have one without the other and be sustainable as a leader, at least not an effectual one. But leaders have influence, and leadership is an intent to influence people, partly to help them to face realities and say, we can't keep on doing things this way, we can't be satisfied, let's admit we're hungry. That is part of what influence is about. Integrity is not just saying it, but doing it. It's 2020 vision. It's inside matching outside. It's intelligent, this leadership, collectively intelligent. The recent book, The Wisdom of Crowds, comes to mind. It was not the way I was taught when I was brought up, but it certainly there's a fair bit to be said for building consensus and using the intelligence of people and paying attention. And authenticity, which is a bit of an antidote for the superficiality that we sometimes get. But these ideals, if you like, have to be attached to contextual roles and realities. And there certainly, as the slide points out, lots of constraints and lots of different mandates that will come historically and by virtue of these being public servants in relationship to elected public servants, if you like. And that tension and working out in the vectors of politics and interests, the dreams that get people elected, and different means for how things get operationalized. And certainly there are lots of challenges and demands, and I'm just suggesting that those are quite situated. So at the center, there's the old saying that I think we have, keeping your eye on the ball. paying attention. You know, it's just true, I think, of life that we get more of what we give attention to. And the more we give certain things attention, the more we'll get of those things. And so part of leadership, for sure, is just putting before the people. I'm talking about staff members. I'm talking about all who would serve. I'm talking about all people as being citizens and equal citizens with access and an opportunity to dialogue of what might constitute a flourishing life for them. Putting all that in front of the people and keeping it there, but doing so with some core commitments. So, an interesting discussion at the forum, and I'm just relaying, paraphrasing some of it by these words that I've spoken and will speak. But as you look at what might constitute universal and particular core commitments that one might have, how do I maintain my steadiness of commitment despite my particular context or the particular demands? So here's something that you can give some thought to, just as those heads of public service did. Let me suggest that we have a voice of personal conscience. For some, you know, it's substituted with Starbucks in the morning, but for some of us too, we a conscience is this sort of plumb line, you could say, that we have. If I want to find out if that wall or any wall is straight, I can put conscience or the plumb line up against the wall to figure out what straight is. I don't really need to be told if I've got that piece of equipment and that hasn't been overdosed with behavior for a long time that I know is wrong. So that is an important thing. How do you enliven the conscience of the people at work in places that have been, in some instances, so very in such difficult circumstance? Then there's professional convictions. I think anyone that's been in a particular sector, vocation, you know what works. You could define, I think, given enough time, what excellence looks like when you see it. And you know what doesn't work and what is going to take you into a tipsy and unwanted way. It's a least preferred way. And to enliven, encourage, and empower people to professional conviction. What about professional constraints, public service constraints? Some of you will know about the African Charter that delineates some specific behaviors, both in terms of, because ethics is always two-sided coin, what you don't do and what you do, right, wrong, good, and virtuous, proprietous and otherwise. It always has the two sides. But there are those kinds of codes, if you like, codes of conduct, codes of behavior. Some are taken for granted codes, some are written down and shared. Some are refined and worked through. Common ethical principles. It just doesn't work in a sustainable way to be dishonest. You define dishonesty as truth-telling, candor, and non-deceit, just to unpack it just at one level. Those just don't work. People breaking promises, for example, perhaps the promises you should have made in the first place, but making promises just isn't going to continue to afford people's confidence in you. And leading is partly about building people's confidence. Moral imagination. The way we've tried to solve this before hasn't worked. We need to go outside the bounds and the boxes of the way we're doing things. How might we do things differently, uniquely? How can we put our indigenous stamp on this from the inside out so we're doing not what someone else tells us we ought to do, but doing it in our kinds of ways? So both an internal and an external integrity, but opening up the possibilities, because some of these problems have not been solved and what we're doing is not necessarily working with them. The whole notion of imagination is being more and more used in the area of the ethical realm. Think of books, and many of them with titles like Ethical Imagination, from one of our Canadian authors, to prophetic imagination, moral imagination, and so forth. So it's a concept that we need to spend a little bit more time on. And perhaps a notion that comes to us from lots of different sources, including African sources, the notion of relational reciprocity. Those of you that are familiar with Martin Buber's work, the I-Thou concept, if that resonates with you, that's partly what we're talking about. But the notion, Mutu, that I'm not just I am not just me. I'm really a part of everyone. I get my breath in a sense from being a part of humanity, not just as an individual, and expressed in lots of different ways, and even certainly within African context, with different words and different meanings. You have this notion of not just acting out of selfishness or greed, talking to permanent secretaries that just watch with aghast as people without, it seems, conscience and without a sense of being any more than singularly selfish, making decisions that look after themselves and not their people. This is part of what it is to have a vision. But important in that vision to see that there are contextual realities and roles, and I'll just go by these very quickly now, just hitting the main points, which is that if we see, if you are in the public service here in Canada, or as the leaders that I had experience with, we have to see that ourselves in different roles with different realities. And one of those roles is certainly as a leader of leaders. And this operationalizes itself in lots of different ways. In this day and age, networking, multi-level leadership, trans-organizational leadership is the way of the days. And there are competencies that are required for that. And I suppose also we could see leaders of leaders as people that just aren't status quo acceptors, but they're status quo disturbers. And that takes courage. Not just the consciousness, not just the competencies, not just the commitment, but the courage to actually act. We call some public service people and executives public servants, civil servants. So if you have an executive member of a country's public service, they might be reminding themselves and other people, as I heard them reminding each other, that they not only serve a larger purpose, so it's not just a binary relationship of lots of masters and servants, but it's a ternary relationship, that is, two servants at different levels in the organizations serving another master. That master is called purpose. That master is called the best interests of our people and our country. And in being a servant of other leaders, they need to cultivate culture. A skill that sometimes isn't taught in the rational, technical kind of training that takes place, or the ability to psychologically be able to get people to do things that you want them to do without them knowing it, or the ability to be able to maneuver through the bureaucracy. These are all worthwhile skills. But moral purpose and professionalism and being a servant of the leaders helps us to navigate cultures that actually begin to generate good things, and begins to see the public service as an ecology as opposed to just a structured system that gets renewed every once in a while. There needs to be mentorship, resonant leadership that really pays attention and listens. Public servants today, wherever they are, need to be people's advocates and see themselves as servants. A few years back, the same group of heads had a Malaysian values expert come in who explained very clearly the difference, and I could be, this is just how I'm hearing the story now, the difference between dog and cat loyalty. That the dog is loyal to the master and the cat to the house, and one is more easily compromised than the other, and this is quite practical in some settings. And so the big house, that is the people, are the ones that need to be primarily kept in our minds. But brokering the common good, and it is a brokering job because there's all sorts of calls for what constitutes the common good and the means to achieving the common goods. And I've already mentioned the need to be purveyors of hope, to be inspirers of hope. And then finally, in terms of some of these roles, and I'll be finishing up in just a minute here, there is this need, and this is certainly where there's been a lot more attention, and it's properly placed, but it hasn't necessarily considered the other three pieces that I've just presented in terms of roles, but the steward of quality public service delivery. So we have lots of attention to performance management, being the entrusted steward, getting management system, e-commerce going, strategic management happening, and making sure that the performance is what it ought to be and leading the way in your own performance. And as you stand back as an African leader in the public service and you look at these roles and you realize that some roles occupy more of your time than others simply because of your position or your situation, but nonetheless, you can see holistically that as you put all of those things together, as you center or anchor down these roles by these common commitments, that you're beginning to emerge with a vision for yourself, and it really needs to be one that you come up with for yourself, but then are able to translate to other people. You can begin to see, as you've seen already in this chart, that a vision for that kind of ethical leadership, and then trying to figure out how for us can we get these commitments translated into the culture. This is an important piece. Because if we can get some ethical enactment, one circumstance, one decision, one person at a time, we begin to gain credibility. And as credibility builds, we begin to see trust building. And as trust begins to be fostered, we have an increase in cultures of quality service to people. The end is sustainable development, flourishing people, the alleviation of those things that are set to by the millennial goals. But ultimately, it's the delivery of service to people and the giving them space to live lives and live them in a way that is much more abundant than they are today. It's a pretty noble task, a pretty high calling. It's a vocation the public service is that really commends itself to people who really want to make a difference, to transform things. As I just finish, so what did these leaders after that discussion have to say? They produce, as happens at all of these meetings, was likewise in another one that I was at in the South Pacific with the heads of the South Pacific region of the Commonwealth. The second point was just the reflection on the critical role of ethical leadership for sustainable development, and a first action point, which you aren't likely to see unless you download the PowerPoint, is to hold themselves accountable for championing ethical leadership cultures for sustainable development through the public service. So what does that mean and what will that look like? Well, what it'll look like one by one is progress, but not progress in the immediate. But the sowing of these ethical cultures will bring, I think, harvest down the road. And finally, this is it's an interesting experience. This was put up, this picture, the exact same slide, for these incredible leaders. And I do mean incredible leaders. They don't need any one of us telling them how to be leaders positionally. You know, it's just as natural to forget as it is to remember when you're in the thick of things under so much pressure. And I just know personally, just met some pretty incredible individuals who could be the head of a public service in any country you could name. But it's an interesting piece here out of Haley's roots. Anytime you see a turtle on a fence post, you know he or she has had some help. Well, it wasn't intended to be this way. And I don't know what strikes your mind or fancy as you see a picture of that poor turtle depicted in that way. But I can tell you that from a high and rarefied ideas and ideals, perhaps some of the ones that I've put out to you today in both description as well as conceptually, it's an interesting thing to hear heads of the public service interpret for themselves what it means to be a turtle on a post. How did I get here? and what am I doing here? Those existential kinds of questions. And ultimately, I think for each of them, they had to sort of begin, as I'm sure many of them had already been on that journey, to figure out what that meant. The irony of postings and being placed in particular places. Who, in fact, puts you on the post? And the answers range from my God to my prime minister, to my people, to my wife, to my husband, to the people I love. And I can't help, whenever I think of the two-thirds world, including part of Canada in that, that we don't need more people and a multiplication of people who see themselves in the light of being a turtle on a post who is able to realize that how they got there, while a mystery, is nonetheless rather sacred and important and altogether noble kind of occupation. One that isn't just about them. In fact, it's not really about them at all. It's about how do we get ethical leadership multiplied throughout the public service, through whatever sector we're in, and do so in a fashion that helps us to accomplish all that we would want to accomplish in terms of sustainable development for whatever country. We've been talking a little bit, very little bit, about Africa today. Thank you.